All right, welcome to today's interview with one of our favorite financial analysts, Mr. Tom Luongo joins us. His website is tomluongo.me, .me. His blog is called Gold, Goats, and Guns. I'm going to get it right. It's three G's, and it's three very important things. I was just saying, Tom, I own goats, too. I have Nigerian dwarf goats, and you were just saying one of your goats gave birth this morning. Is that right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, she did. And she's a mini Nubian, so she's half Nigerian dwarf, half Nubian.
Oh, that's great.
And she's one of my older does, and we were really a little worried about her, because last year's birth for her was pretty traumatic, actually, and being an older doe, and we weren't sure what was going to happen, and we were literally laying out in the shelter with her last night until about 10:30, going, "Are you going to have these tonight or what?" And we didn't want to wake up in the morning and have what we had last year, which was to have her laying down in the mud with a kid half out of her and she nearly dead, which is what happened last year. We were able to get her through that, and we saved the kids and saved her. And then she had two beautiful kids this morning. Everything worked out okay. So,
oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. That's wonderful. I love the fact that you have so many different animals there as well. We love animals too. We have our Belgian Malinois right here in front of the desk in our studio. Hey, there's something else we have in common, Tom, that I learned about from listening to many of your interviews. I mean, I'm a fan of your work, by the way, and I love to listen to your interviews. I love the fact that you don't hold back. I love the fact that you are opinionated, because I think you're correct, but we'll get to that. You and I both have, you have a background in chemistry and running analytical instruments in chemistry. And yes. I was so shocked to find that out, because, I'm the lab director of our ICP-MS lab. We do heavy metals analysis for food analysis.
I used to do that. I never did ICP-MS, honestly, but I jockeyed in ICP AES for years. So atomic emission spectroscopy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. And food analysis. I worked for food lab for a while. I got fired from that job.
Is that right?
We used to do fat and analysis, like calcium, magnesium and whatnot.
Oh yeah.
For food analysis, for what's the word I'm looking for? The USDA,
just like nutrition label, facts, right? Label, so compliance,
the nutrition labeling. Thank
yeah.
you. Yeah. No, seriously. I used to do this years ago.
That's amazing. I was really stunned to learn that about you. And we, just yesterday we received shipment of, a new gas chromatography interface for our triple quad. And we're going to use that to test for dioxins in the food.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's like, nice. I mean,
wow. So you're just, so a triple quadrupole mass. Triple quadrupole mass spec to do. GCM, yeah, the GC, yeah, no,
that, yeah.
I didn't do a lot of GC in my life, but a lot of metals analysis I used to do. I atomic absorption, graphite furnace atomic absorption for me was the big thing. I did a lot of years that. I've done SEM work. I've jockeyed in ICP. I've done it all.
See, I'm not surprised to learn that, because I consider you to be a very bright person. I think you have a really good grasp of what's going on globally, connecting the dots on the financial situation, and the fact that you're kind of a multidisciplinary person is no surprise. But let's get into the financial side, if you don't mind. For those listeners who are new to you, the phenomenon that is Tom Luongo, and your current, let's say, the core theory that you are espousing, and some people get it, some people criticize it, which is fine, but could you just give us a quick summary of this theory of Jay Powell, the Fed, the Euro, all of this?
Sure. So when you have interest rates at the zero bound for close to 15 years, thanks to the Greenspan put, because Alan Greenspan liked to live in the limelight and be the accepted new cool kid on the block, to then have the Fed run by committed, in my mind, communists, Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen. And we're at the zero bound for all these years. They're the ones that created this immense level of offshore credit leverage within the dollar markets. And so Jay Powell has always been the guy at the Fed saying no to all of this. And he's always been a kind of a hawkish figure. He's always been part of that group that was a bunch of hawks. And so when he became Federal Reserve Chair, he was very adamant that he wanted to normalize interest rates. Now, the question is, when you think about it, so much of what what I like to call Davos, is trying to accomplish can only be done with the extension of zero bound interest rates into perpetuity. And for Powell to aggressively raise interest rates the way he has, is a very strong signal that he's not doing so to quote unquote tame inflation, that that's the cover story from the Keynesian perspective. We have to raise interest rates to tame inflation because the Keynesians only think of things from the demand side of the curve. But we have a problem in that coming out of COVID, we were dealing with supply chain problems. We were dealing with a cost push inflationary model, and which is that we had broken supply chains. And so there weren't enough goods getting to market, and prices were rising simply because people were willing to bid whatever they could get for. They were willing to bid anything to get gasoline, food, this, that, and anything else. And that's what was pushing inflation higher, along with all the CARES Act spending, which Powell sterilized starting in the middle of 2021 when he raised the reverse repo rate, payout rate by the Fed, 5 basis points above the Fed funds rate, which sucked $2 trillion into the reverse repo market. So, and the people who've been screaming about this the most are over in Europe, okay? The American banks haven't been screaming about it. So it was clear to me that if the United States wanted to regain control over its monetary policy and wanted to push back against this push towards MMT, central bank digital currencies, and all the rest of it, well, that would mean that the Fed doesn't need to exist anymore and that the commercial banking interests don't need to exist anymore because they want to do away with the two-tiered monetary system, which goes from that the central bank issues the currency to the commercial banks, and the commercial banks then lend that out into the real world. Well, what Davos wants to do is collapse that so that you deal directly with the central bank and we cut out the commercial banks.
Right.
Well, who does the Fed work for? Fed doesn't work for Klaus Schwab.
That's right.
The Fed works for Jamie Dimon. Yeah, it works for JP Morgan. It works for whomever is they work for the commercial banks. So, and at the end of the day, that's who they're supposed to serve, along with the quote unquote dual mandate from Congress for stable prices and full employment, which, by the way, are mutually exclusive mandates, which is part of the reason why the Fed has always been such a mess. So to me, it's very obvious that watching Powell do what he's been doing is been going completely against the grain of what the globalist architecture of a globalist plan is, which is to collapse the old monetary system and default on all the pensions and then issue perpetual debt and you put everybody on UBI, default on the pensions and all the rest of it. But Powell's saying, no, we're going to have the commercial banks still be at the center of capital formation in the West. And we're not going to give up the dollar reserve currency, which would be the case if they say that the zero bound. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it seems like Powell is in a very delicate bind right here because, of course, the more he raises rates to fight the Davos crowd, the more precarious the debt holdings are of a lot of domestic banks, and as we've already seen. So how does he navigate that tightrope?
He does so by eventually stopping raising interest rates. Right.
Do you
we're
think
not
he's
sure
there
where
now?
That's going to be. I think he may be. I don't think he's quite done yet. But what he really wants to do is shrink the Fed's balance sheet. What he really wants to do is wring excessive leverage out of the system. I've been saying that it's, the talking point that I've kind of like reduced this down to is the Fed's not trying to fight inflation by raising rates. They're trying to kill the euro dollar system, the offshore dollar system.
Right.
But that's not quite fair because it's really the leverage within the offshore dollar system. He wants to get rid of the infinite leverage created by the zero bound, which is what happens when you go to zero. You can now, money is free so that you can lever up in the shadow banking system to infinity.
Right.
And therefore take away the Fed's ability to actually conduct monetary policy. So how does he thread this? He threads it by doing exactly what he's done so far and watch the fallout and shore up the commercial banking system here in the United States by setting up a virtuous cycle for the domestic banks to shore up their balance sheets. And part of what the Bank Term Funding Program, which was announced during the blow up of Silicon Valley Bank, was to allow those, say, the regional banks that may have these big holes in their balance sheets when they had to put U.S. Treasuries on their balance sheets to offset their deposits. And they bought those things that say, 1.5%, 2% on the 10-year, it goes to 4%. They're down 20, 25% on their reserves are down that much. Then what he's allowed them to do is to pledge those at par to the Fed and then go into the market and buy new ones
at face value. Rates,
at face value and fill the hole in their balance sheets. Now, who's hurt by this? The ones who can't do that.
Exactly. The European banks. All right. So Jay Powell, he drilled a giant hole in the side of the Titanic, but he has enough lifeboats for the domestic banks.
Yes.
To keep them afloat. Meanwhile, do you think his strategy is working in Europe? How does the buyout of Credit Suisse fit into this?
The buyout of Credit Suisse is different because, well, there's two reasons. One, it's actually part of it because, to remind everybody, Credit Suisse is the primary dealer of U.S. Treasuries. So in no way, manner, shape, or form was the Fed going to let a primary dealer go down.
Right.
Right. So what happened with Credit Suisse is very kind of when you look at it, was to force the merger of Credit Suisse and UBS as brokered by the Swiss National Bank, who technically, quote unquote, broke the law.
Yes.
Well, but did they? Because there were covenants within those AT1 cocoa bonds that Credit Suisse had on their balance sheet that they could do that under extreme circumstances. Okay. So the idea that the Swiss National Bank broke the law, within Swiss banking law, no, that was allowed. In European banking law, they wouldn't be able to do that. So the AT1 cocoa bonds that exist within the European banking system are under a different set of covenants. So what they were able to do there is they write those AT1 bonds down to zero and stiff those bondholders. Because here's the thing.
What's that? It's about $17 billion. Is that what that was?
Yeah, it was $17 billion. Now think about this for just a second. I want you to realize what was going on here. Under normal circumstances, the bondholders would be in front of the shareholders in Credit Suisse. So if Credit Suisse were to, so think of it this way. If you liquidate Credit Suisse, well, what happens? The bondholders get paid out first. They get converted into equity. They become the owners of Credit Suisse. If you drive the market cap, for example, of Credit Suisse down to $17 billion, right? When you convert the $17 billion in debt into equity, they are now 50% owners of the new company. Because you had to issue another, you know, you had to double the number of shares that were out there. So now whoever holds those bonds becomes the owners of Credit Suisse. That also works as a reverse poison pill for anybody trying to buy Credit Suisse.
Interesting.
Because then, you know, on the day before Credit Suisse was this deal was brokered, UBS's market cap was down to $56 billion. So that $17 billion would have then represented like a 30% ownership stake in UBS. And they would have wound up, these same people would have wound up owning UBS credit, the new UBS Credit Suisse entity that was created. So by writing those cocoa bonds down to zero, you bypass all of that. UBS and Credit Suisse are still owned by their existing ownership. And the Swiss National Bank still has their transmission system for their monetary policy. And the Fed still is able to defend its primary, one of its primary dealers for U.S. Treasuries in the European market. Now, the kicker is to this, as to why this fits into everything I've been saying, is because, as they complained about it, the European Central Bank and the European Banking Commission were not consulted in this deal whatsoever. The Fed, Swiss National Bank, Credit Suisse, and UBS were involved. And I have it on not good authority, but I have my suspicions that the Bundesbank was involved as well in Germany. And the fact that none of these people talked to the EU about this tells me everything I need to know that I've been correct in my assessment that the Fed is actually targeting the European Central Bank and breaking with this policy that we're going to inflate to infinity to fight climate change and right. fight an infinite war against the Russians, which is the reason that they want to do this. And which is the reason they want all this to happen. So then, cover story.
That's fascinating, Tom. So then for Powell to inflict as much pain on the Davos crowd here, if he can't raise rates, he could at least hold them where they are as long as possible. And that seems to be consistent with their plan. Go ahead.
Yeah, and then at the same time, allow, as Daniel DiMartino Booth keeps saying, let QT chunk away in the background, selling off U.S. Treasuries, selling off mortgage-backed securities wherever it's possible. And shrinking the balance sheet. You shrink the balance sheet, you shrink the credit markets, you shrink the leverage out of the system, and the Fed, you know, it's not going to be easy to get out of this. It's clear this is what their plan is. And I caution everybody to, when I talk about this, to say that, look, I'm not saying that the Fed is doing anything here that they wouldn't do in order to survive themselves. They are under existential threat. Okay? It's just that simple from outside forces who clearly want to change over the way we handle capital and how we do capital formation. Are we ideologically going to use commercial banking and private risk assessment to affect the formation of new capital? or are we going to put it in the hands of central planners and the central banks and thereby the central governments through a central bank digital currency and all that that entails? Well, and that's the fundamental fight here. And I think that it's very clear that Wall Street doesn't want to give up this power, and they never have. And they're going to fight the old colonial European powers who were broke.
So I'm getting a picture of like two giant Godzillas fighting, and we the people are like buildings are falling on us, and there's rubble smashing our cars, and we're trying to escape the Godzilla feet, the giant feet that are stomping around, because you know just trying to keep our small business going or whatever. But there's definitely some fallout that's happening from this.
Sure.
But aren't we also seeing a lot of faith lost in the domestic banking system because of the outflows out of the U.S. banks have been tremendous since SVB collapsed? And even I think last week was $26 billion in outflows from the banks. Now, maybe some of that went into treasuries.
Sure.
Probably did. Some did. Yeah,
it did. A lot of it. A lot of people are opening up treasury direct accounts. Right.
Okay.
Now.
Yeah. Makes sense.
I had Oakley on the podcast on the Gold Goats and Guns podcast a few weeks ago. And he's like, yeah, I'm in variable rate U.S. treasuries. I don't know when Powell's going to stop raising rates. And I know a lot of people, I've talked to a lot of people, and they're all doing the same thing. But this is also part of the transition period. This is what has to happen. You have to create a virtuous cycle at this point for demand for U.S. treasuries. At the same time, okay, the Europeans are desperate for collateral. Okay. And the Fed has something they put in place in July of 2021 called FIMA, F-I-M-A, which is basically a foreign repo facility. Because the U.S. domestic banks will not accept European sovereign debt as repo collateral in the private transactions, the only recourse to get U.S. treasuries is to go to the Fed. The Fed opened up this facility 2 years ago on purpose. And interestingly enough, Martin Armstrong was talking about this, and he said, look, go look at what happened with FIMA. During Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse, and certainly it was during Credit Suisse, they tapped FIMA for $60 billion worth of U.S. treasuries. Okay. Previously, during COVID, I think it was $1.4 billion. But really, FIMA didn't really come into existence in its current form until late July of 2021, at the July 28th, 2021 meeting, right? So this is a big thing. So a lot of the inversion we're seeing in the U.S. yield curve is coming from the European Central Bank and the European banking system buying U.S. treasuries to get collateral to shore up the offshore dollar markets and their U.S. dollar liabilities. And they're actually buying the stuff that the Chinese are selling and the Japanese have been selling and other central banks have been selling to defend their currencies as the dollar rises and as rates rise. And it's very clear if you map the TIC report, the Treasury International Capital Report, and you break it down by region of the world. I've broken it down by Eurozone, rest of the world, and Asia Pacific. And you can see it's clear as day, Asia Pacific has been selling, the Europeans have been buying, and the rest of the world is kind of neutral. And so, and this was going on all throughout 2022 and up until the last, and then in Q4, there was just net buying in 2022. Now, we don't have the latest numbers for Q1 because the Treasury International Capital Report, the TIC report, is 3 months in arrears. So we won't see what happened in Silicon Valley Bank and around Credit Suisse in those numbers until like June.
Okay? Right, right.
So, but I suspect that when we get those numbers in June, it's going to bear out that you'll see like Bermuda and the Caymans and Belgium, which is where Euroclear is, and a variety of other, you know, Eurozone markers will show net buying of treasuries. And that's part of the reason why the inversion on the U.S. yield curve has persisted. And some of it is that there's a recession. There's going to be a credit deflationary induced recession on the horizon as well. I just don't think it's going to happen in 2023.
Oh, really?
I think it's going to happen in 2024. So.
Okay. All right. Well, so many questions from that. So let me ask you this.
Sure.
In addition to people taking deposits and putting them into treasuries, we've also seen, this is a crypto question. So we've also seen Bitcoin, I think, just hit 30,000 today.
Yeah.
So it's recovered quite a lot from where it was. The theory is that some people are choosing to look at crypto more seriously now that there's been, you know, a lot of the fallout, the FTX fallout has kind of, you know, burned out the underbrush of fraudsters and hucksters and whatever, not that they ever completely go away. But what's your take on crypto right now as an alternative? Are more people looking at it at the moment, or what do you think?
I just think that there's no liquidity in Bitcoin. I think there are people, I think that, you know, whatever net buying is there, and there's just, it's just a directional trade because all the leverage from all of these Ponzi schemes that were, we called DeFi for 3 years, is gone. The Fed blew up Terra Luna and, you know, FTX.
Yeah, Three Arrows Capital, all of it, yeah.
Right, all of this stuff. And so it's all gone. And then if you look at, if you go look at a weekly chart of Bitcoin, and I'm not going to pull it up here, but you go look at a weekly chart of Bitcoin, there's about like an 8 or 9 week period where Bitcoin didn't move. Like, you know, it didn't move, $1,000 a week. And, you know, Bitcoin usually moves $5,000 to $6,000 low to high on a weekly basis. So we were looking at almost historic levels of a lack of volatility in Bitcoin, right? The last time we saw anything like that was right before Bitcoin broke out in November of 2019, like in the 6 or 8 weeks, maybe even 13 weeks, I think, if I remember correctly, there, you know, Bitcoin's trading like in a very tight band, right? $8,800. And then boom, it started to move. And then once it closed above 14 grand on a quarterly closing basis, I told everybody to go long, and it went, shot up to 68 grand. And then on the way back down, once I saw this like historic level of lack of volatility, then the question becomes at that point is, are we getting set up for the next slammy, right? Or is the next big stablecoin going to get blown up by the Fed? Or have we wrung out all of the leverage within the crypto markets or the Bitcoin market, to be explicit? I also talked to some people who were much closer to that, watch the on-chain statistics in Bitcoin carefully. And they all pointed the same thing, which is that a lot of Bitcoins were taken off the exchanges and put into cold storage. So that means there's no liquidity. Therefore, if there's no liquidity, there's no leverage within the futures markets. And so any buying whatsoever under those circumstances is going to see the thing pop. And that's in many ways what we've seen. And then it ran right up to 28 grand, which was, you know, technically, there was some overhead resistance at 28 grand. And then we've moved back into the 30s, which is actually really quite impressive as well. I just don't know that it's much more than that, which is also good because now we're getting back into real price discovery in Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, exactly. But my follow-up question there is, So getting to the Fed and Jay Powell, so he's at war with the Davos crowd, as you mentioned, but then it seems like the Fed also is at war with domestic crypto that they don't control. I mean, would you agree or disagree with that statement? Because, you know, the Fed now interim system and so on, doesn't the Fed ultimately want to control digital currency in the United States?
Well, what they want is, and what they need is a better back end than they currently have for payment layers and interbank payments. And that's what FedNow really is. I don't know that the Fed is really hostile to Bitcoin. Okay, Powell's made it abundantly clear that he hates stable coins.
Right,
stable
right.
coins to him are just synthetic dollars, which they're basically just euro dollars. And he's at war with, and then they're easily leveraged euro dollars against magic beans, not even against, you know, freaking euros or British pound.
Right.
Or,
no, like Tether.
Know, they're just like literal euro dollars, you know, created and collateralized by magic beans. This is insane. That all needs to go away. But as far as Bitcoin's concerned, the Fed, for the most part, has been very clear. They consider it a commodity. So very similar to gold. They don't like the idea of Bitcoin and gold, you know, making their dollar look bad. But I think at a certain point, the Fed has to choose, you know, like the ECB has to choose. And I'll explain what I mean by this in a minute. I've been saying for a long time now that Christine Lagarde is trying to maintain credit spreads between European, like between German and Italian debt and between German and US debt. And she can defend those credit spreads in order to keep interest rate swap arrangements and carry trades and all the rest of it from blowing up on her and then blowing up her banking system. Well, she can choose between maintaining credit spreads or she can defend the euro, but she can't do both at the same time. Because in order to defend credit spreads, you got to sell the euro. And if you want to defend the euro, then you got to let the credit spreads go. And if you watch like US-German credit spreads, they have tightened dramatically over the last year and a half. So by the same token, if the Fed wants to shore up the American banking system and wring out some of this excessive leverage, they're going to have to allow people to escape, and they can't really defend the gold price the way they have in the past, the dollar versus gold and the dollar versus Bitcoin in the past. They're going to have to let those go as well. Same kind of problem that the Fed is running into, which is why I don't see the Fed really upset with the gold at $2,000 in the cash market. Silver back at 25. Not that I really think that silver is much of a monetary metal at this point. But the same thing, I don't think they really care about Bitcoin too much. As long as there's no excessive leverage building within the crypto market, certainly within the Bitcoin market, I don't think they care. And to be honest with you, there's so much leverage that's been taken out of the gold markets as well. Like, you know, the amount of paper gold trading on the COMEX and the LBMA, much, much lower than it was even 2 or 3 years ago. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think that there's a lot of, you know, there's trade-offs for everybody. And if they want to defend one thing, they're going to have to let something else go. And so the years of being able to manipulate all the prices all the time goes away at 5% interest rates as opposed to 0%.
Good point. That's a really great way to describe it. Now, you mentioned Christine Lagarde of the ECB, and I'm sure you saw this video where she thought she was talking to Zelensky. It was the fake Zelensky interview, which is really hilarious because I thought the real Zelensky was also a fake Zelensky, but whatever. it's like fake clown Zelensky time. But she admitted in that interview that they wanted to use the digital currency, the digital euro, to control people. And she expressed fear that they might not have enough control over smaller transactions. I think she said 300 to 400 euros, but anything over that, definitely they would exert control over people. This is a fairly frank admission, but it shows that, you know, the whole model of the socialist system in Europe is one of totalitarian control over your finances, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. They absolutely want to do away with the classic supply and demand elasticity curve. They just want to flatten it and tell you what the demand for these things will be and what the demand for those things will be and what the prices will be. Lagarde is a totalitarian. She was put in power to do what she's doing. She's made it abundantly clear that she hates Bitcoin specifically. Doesn't really have much of a problem with stable coins. What a shock. But she hates Bitcoin. Because Bitcoin represents an escape hatch. And she said this explicitly. Bitcoin is an escape hatch. And if there's an escape hatch, then people will use it. And we need to have control over these things. Because their plan, Mike, is especially if you go back to the Credit Suisse. And I wrote an article about this over at the blog, trying to explain what was happening with Credit Suisse. And I came to the realization that the whole AT1 cocoa bond market was a means by which Davos was going to take control of the entire commercial banking system in Europe. Through these bonds, by once there's a full-on banking crisis and all the market caps of all the European banks get halved or dropped by 75, 80%, that the value, relatively speaking, of all that those $275 billion in cocoa bonds now, relative to, say, today's valuations, would rise in value to $1 trillion or $1.5 trillion. And all of a sudden, again, like I explained with Credit Suisse and UBS, they become the owners of these banks. Wow. Now once you've got them, they've got control of those banks, and you know, is installed effectively as owners. Now you can roll up the central banks, because now the central banks and the member central banks, and they own the commercial banks. Now they can turn the member central banks into adjuncts of the ECB, and they can roll the whole thing up into one big mess underneath where the member central banks, like in, you know, in Germany and France and the rest of them, they become the new commercial banks. The old commercial banks are gone. They become the new commercial banks. They deal directly with the ECB with a digital euro. They default on all the debt, right? Because remember, these AT1 bonds are perpetual bonds. Okay, so where have you heard the term perpetual bonds before, except from George Soros, who has been screaming for years that the way out for Europe is to issue perpetual bonds, is to default on all the debt and issue perpetual bonds to the current bondholders. And then, so effectively saying you're not going to get your capital back, but we're going to pay you in perpetuity. Okay, right. So that's what these AT1 bonds are, except they're conditionally convertible into equity. Right.
It's like a Trojan horse into the Great Reset.
Right. It's absolutely what it is. And then ultimately, then all of this stuff happens, and you know, and then once the commercial bank, they own the commercial banks, then they can turn to the central banks and go, okay, now we're going to default on all the national central debt and issue perpetual debt through those, you know, through the Bundesbank and all the rest of them. And then
This is fascinating because you're describing the pathway to a global one world currency that eventually becomes a digital one world currency, or at least that's their attempt.
That's their attempt. Yeah.
Yeah, that's their attempt.
They want that for the United States, and the Fed is saying no.
What about, exactly, right. This is really critical. But what about the BIS and how they want to position themselves, I believe, as the kind of middleman between the digital currencies of different countries? Sure. Don't they want to, isn't the BIS actually where the one world currency wants to be kind of controlled?
Eventually go between them and the IMF, sure. Then they want to transfer all of that away from, you know, the ECB, the Fed, the
right.
PBOC, and all the rest of them. Then they just transfer it all up to the IMF and the BIS.
Yeah, they don't want the Fed to exist at all.
It's been banging on this point for years that was always the point. Now, here's the problem. The problem is that everybody east of the international north-south transport corridor is not on board with this. The Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, the Indians, now the Saudi Arabians, even though they're
exactly
the west of, like, they're not on board with this. 70% of the world's population is governed by people who don't want to be involved in this. ASEAN just came out the other day and said we're gonna start moving all of our trade settlement into Chinese yuan. By the way, the Chinese yuan, I've been studying this for about 12 years now. The PBOC, the People's Bank of China, does not target the US dollar onshore yuan exchange rate. That is not how they manage the yuan. They manage it through the real effective exchange rate of the yuan versus all of their trading partners. They've been doing this for years. So they care as much about the dollar as the Singapore dollar, the Malaysian ringgit, the Thai baht, the Australian dollar, the Vietnamese dong, all of them. That's what they care about. And they're managing the currency versus that. But we always focus on things in terms of dollars. And we don't understand any of this stuff. So understanding that they've been like targeting all this and working from that perspective for years. Like, so this is all, you know, in play here. It's all already happening. And there's not much Davos can do about it other than bomb them back to the Stone Age using the U.S. military.
Which is running out of munitions in the meantime, right?
Well, you know, I'm not even going to say one way or the other whether we have the ability to or to not fight this war that they clearly want to have for us. I don't know. Okay. And I'm not cucking out here. What I'm saying is don't believe everything you hear, because so much of everything we hear is disinformation. That may be correct. Okay. It may not be. Okay. Like, how much of that is real and how much of it is, you know, planted? I don't know.
Yeah.
What I know is that they're planning on doing this and they're planning on trying to take us to war by the end of the year, I think. And what I see, they're planning on it. Now, whether they're doing that in order to, there's a number of ways you can look at why they would be doing this. If Davos is trying to destroy the United States, what better way to do so than to get us involved in a war with Russia and China and lose?
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
Okay. All right. So there's a number of different ways this could be looked at as to why they're doing what they're doing, but don't discount any of what's actually happening. They could think they can win. They think they could not win. I don't know.
But
what I know is that everybody is making these moves as if they have a winning move on in the future. And that when you look at their whiteboard of their flow chart of how this plays out, of what moves they're going to make and when, they still believe that, you know, winning is at the bottom of the whiteboard. And that should scare you because that's the way they're acting.
Okay, so on your whiteboard then, do you think the ECB survives this?
That's a good question. I don't. In my heart of hearts, I hope it doesn't. You know, if I take these off and I put on my rose-colored glasses, you know, my anti-communist glasses, I go, please no. These people are the problem. And, you know, the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians, we can negotiate a way out of this with these people. Like, but the old colonialist powers in Europe, there ain't no negotiating with these people.
Right.
And we've already had two world wars because of them. And they want to have, and we have 1,000 years of European history of, you know, them fighting wars amongst themselves for roughly the same reasons. And they've been undermining U.S. foreign policy and U.S. domestic policy through the ownership of the U.S. banking system for most of America's history.
Yeah.
So, right. And we're now in the weird transition period where we, for the first time in American history, have control over our debt indexing rate, over the price of our own currency in foreign exchange markets, i.e. SOFR versus LIBOR.
Uh-huh, right, right.
So
and that transition is kicking in when?
June 30th, LIBOR goes away, and okay. SOFR, and everything that's not currently been rewritten, to be in any contracts or debt or whatever that hasn't been explicitly rewritten by the lawyers to get all this stuff done in from LIBOR to SOFR, the transition, there's a whole roadmap of how they're going to deal with that. I've seen the documents and I've seen the road plan, the roadmap and how they'll deal with this.
It's going to be an exciting summer. That's for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So, last question for you then, sure. And then I want to give you a chance to plug your newsletter and anything else you want to mention. But so for someone who doesn't follow this daily, like you do, this is a lot to take in. And right. I think a typical viewer may be just trying to ask the question. So how do I navigate this and not lose everything? It is kind of the number one question. Do you have any words of wisdom for that?
It's actually really quite simple. We don't call it gold, goats, and guns for nothing. Like, I want to get like flip about it. It's pretty obvious. It's tangible assets. Martin Armstrong has been banging his shoe on the table like Khrushchev for the last 10 years that we're moving into a period of tangible assets are going to rule versus ephemeral assets or intangible assets. Debt has ruled the world for the last however long you want to call the cycle since Nixon closed the gold window in 71. Well, the remonetization effect of everybody moving to ground, what you're seeing in gold, Bitcoin, U.S. treasuries, the Dow versus other stock markets and whatnot, you're seeing just people moving into tangible assets. Okay. So what should you be doing? Well, you should be shoring up your personal balance sheet. What's the Fed trying to do? Shrink its balance sheet of all this toxic overvalued debt that it can't sell because it can't sell it at par without booking a loss, but it can roll it off its balance sheet and just not, not roll it over and then let it, sunset. And then the money, of course, that was backed by it sunsets as well. So it's the same thing here. Get out of debt if you can. Shore up your skill set so that you don't lose your job, right? If you have excess capital, you're looking at putting your assets to start out with. If you don't have enough like liquid wealth, and I mean liquid meaning stuff to pay your bills in case you lose your job or you have a medical emergency or whatever. So gold, Bitcoin, cash, if you're an American, you should have all three of these things. And if you're a European, you should have some euros as well. But again, that's only because you're paying your bills in euros. But since I think the euro is going to 60 cents, I wouldn't keep very many of them.
Right.
So you want to be in gold, Bitcoin, in your local currency and just enough local currency and held somewhat outside the banking system in order for you to function. Okay.
Yeah.
But if you're worried about, the kind of you're worried about them canceling the currency and then forcing you to bring your stuff in, bring them in and change them out. Well, got news for you. I got Bitcoin. I got gold. I got these things. I got to convert them into those things. The other things I need first, and then I can convert into the new currency. Like you win for the most part. They're not going to let you out of the system without making you take a haircut. They're not going to, try and tax you into debt slavery. They're going to do all of this stuff. And what you have to do is, minimize your counterparty risks. Okay. Because it's counterparty risk that everybody is facing. The other right. guy not being able to pay. And so just minimize your counterparty risk as best as possible. Shore up your local community as best you can. Shore up your skill set as best you can. And protect yourself. Right now, you should be worried about, and that's what we're seeing in the banking system. People are worried. I get patrons asking me all the time, what bank should I move my money out of? Because I'm worried my bank is going to fail. Well, I don't know. I don't actually honestly believe your bank is going to fail here if you're here in the United States. I think some of the banks are going to fail. I think we're overbanked in the United States, but I don't know without looking at the Texas ratio of a particular bank. And it's time to do the due diligence and shore yourself up.
Yeah. And gold, goats, and guns all have no counterparty risk.
Yes.
By the way, that's a good rule of thumb. Okay. Your newsletter, how often do you put the newsletter out? And
out is a monthly retail investor focused newsletter. It has a portfolio, which has done very well over the years. And it's built around the ideas of, these things, income, industry, defense, right? Gold, goats, and guns. And we put that out once a month. It's all original material. My partner, Dexter White, writes one article. I write the rest of it. And, we try and, thematically push us forward in time is what we're going to see. The Patreon, I take care of my patrons anywhere from 3 to 5 times a week with private blog posts, private podcasts, market reports, bespoke chart reads on people. I'm, fairly accomplished technical analysts as well. So, and we just do the thing. And then we have a very active community. that we all talk amongst ourselves with. So,
okay. And I see it's like ridiculously affordable. If they go to your website, tomluongo.me, click on the newsletter. You can select a membership level here, mm-hmm. and it's just a few dollars. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
The prices were set when nobody knew who the hell I was. What was I going to do? Charge them premium money for something else? And we're at the point now where it's fine. The goal here is not making money is a consequence of doing good work, right? I've always believed this. And if you do good work, people will reward you.
Yes.
And it's the crowdfunding model is very real, and I firmly believe in it. And we're very thankful every day for our patrons, because I learn more from them than I learn from my own research, because you have an energized and inspired community that you riff off of every day.
Yeah.
And it's a pleasure to go to work, which is, for me, is I wake up in my pajamas in the morning, I pull up a cup of coffee and I sit in front of the computer and I go, and they bring me the world. They're phenomenal. Like, I can't say enough about them. So,
well, that's wonderful. You have an amazing community and you have an amazing grasp too, I think, of what's going on globally. I really encourage people to tune in to your message. And I want to thank you for taking the time to join us today, Tom. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Mike. As always, it was great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and take care. And as always, for those of you watching, you may repost this interview anywhere you'd like. Go ahead and do so. Just give a link to tomluongo.me. And thank you for watching today. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon.com, the free speech platform that you're also free to use. So thanks for watching, everybody. Get prepared. Take care. All right, today's interview is brought to you by our gold and silver sponsor, which is the Treasure Island Coins and Precious Metals Company. You can find them at metalswithmike.com. And why this company is so trustworthy, I mean, they show you prices in real time on their website, as you can see here. You can actually see the prices. These are a little bit outdated, these prices right here. But if you go there live, you'll see today's price based on the spot price. This company's parent group provides an enormous percentage of the gold and silver to other retailers across the United States. And so they know this industry. They've known it for, frankly, for decades. This is a second generation owner of the Treasure Island Company, and they offer discreet delivery, insured delivery, and they can also help you with silver IRAs that are IRS compliant. So if it fits in your plan to have physical gold and silver in your possession, check out the Treasure Island Coins and Precious Metals Company. The website again is metalswithmike.com. They are our sponsor in this space, but they don't pay us any affiliate fees whatsoever. We don't earn a percentage of any purchases. They just pay a flat fee for sponsorship, and then we use those resources along with other sponsors to build a better Brighteon. And we've got a lot of new features they're about to roll out because of that, and we have a better 24/7 response admins and programmers and so on. So we thank Treasure Island and other sponsors for their support, and we thank you for your support, and get yourself squared away. Times are dicey, banks are insolvent, so figure out if this is right for you, and if it is, do your own research. Give them a call, metalswithmike.com. A global reset is coming, and that's why I've recorded a new 9-hour audiobook. It's called The Global Reset Survival Guide. You can download it for free by subscribing to the naturalnews.com email newsletter, which is also free. I'll describe how the monetary system fails. I also cover emergency medicine and first aid and what to buy to help you avoid infections. So download this guide. It's free. It's my gift to you simply because I want like-minded people to survive.